silly questions from Ben because he's scared of Elixir and Phoenix.
I think I would be a little quiet on this talk. I don't know.
This is the Meteor Club Podcast, a weekly roundtable discussion about all things Meteor.
Welcome, Meteor fans, to the Meteor Club Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Owens, along with my fearful co-host,
Ben Strahan. Totally not fearful, bro.
Fear the Phoenix.
I totally am fearful. All right, let's do this.
So lately, there's been a little, noise in the Meteor community. Some people dabbling into Phoenix, Elixir and Phoenix. And so I thought it'd be fun to do a show on that. Obviously, if you listen, you heard the last show was on Dun.js. So spreading our wings a little bit and finding out about other technologies. You know, we've done stuff with React before, and we actually have Sam Korkos from the React episode with us. Welcome, Sam.
Hey there, Josh.
So you've actually been dabbling a little bit in Phoenix lately too, right?
I have, about the last week and a half or so. I've been playing with Phoenix, and it's I'm really starting to like it. It's not as complicated as I was expecting.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. All right. And so our other guest today is the guy that made Phoenix, Chris McCord. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thanks for having me on. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So you work at Dockyard, is that right?
Yep. Yeah, I started there about maybe a month and a half ago.
Nice.
And I'm working primarily on Phoenix itself.
Oh. So,
good move for me and good things for the framework coming out of it.
That's awesome. That's always interesting too, because like what happened with Node and Ryan Dahl, like do you still like retain all the rights to Phoenix and the work that you're doing or?
Yeah. Dockyard's been really great about it. Yeah. So it all remains my intellectual property. And, they're making big bets on the framework for, Dockyard definitely, they do a lot of Ember development, which they'll continue to do, but they were doing a lot of Ruby and Rails on the back end. Early on, I think January of this year, they made public bets way before Phoenix 1.0 that they were going to transition all of their back end development over to Elixir and Phoenix. So, they see it as, a good thing for them in the community to support the framework. And it all remains, all my intellectual property license is all the same.
That's awesome.
I noticed when I went to the Dockyard website that right on the header, it's like we're the first dedicated Phoenix development team.
Yep.
So that's like solid. Like they're totally behind you.
Yep. And like I said, early on, January this year, they were publicly behind it very early. So it's been great.
That's kind of awesome. Very different than the Meteor story, perhaps.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah. No $20 million, but it's awesome to see that, you're not working full time.
Not yet, right?
For those that don't know, like what is Elixir and then how does like Phoenix kind of play into all that?
Sure. Yeah. So the elevator pitch for Elixir, runs on the Erlang virtual machine. So some people may or may not be familiar with Erlang, which is a language that's been around since the mid 1980s. Like, I have a CS degree and Erlang was never mentioned once. So it's like ignored by the programming community at large, but they solved a lot of problems around concurrency and distributed computing decades ago. And then were ignored. But it's out there and it's battle tested. So it runs about half the world's telecommunication systems today. So it was built by Ericsson to have a language that was distributed and fault tolerant. To run telecommunication systems. And it's done that to amazing success since like 90s and on. And then somewhat recently, it was open source in like 1998. And then some really impressive startups and companies have been built on top of it outside of telecommunication. WhatsApp is probably the most recent notorious example. They're running 2 million connections per server and they were running, they were $19 billion acquisition. And I think they had like 30 engineers working on the whole system, supporting hundreds of millions of users. And that was built on Erlang. But Erlang has, I'd say some historical warts a little bit. It was a language designed in the 80s and it has really focused on systems that are designed to run for years and years. So part of that has been, I'd say it hasn't progressed to some of the more up-to-date features you'd expect out of a modern language. I think it's getting there, but it's had kind of this slow crawl, and it has historically focused on solving these grittier problems around how do you run programs distributively. So they didn't really tackle ease of use, onboarding, and some nice features that we'd expect today. So that's where Jose Valim came in and created Elixir around, I think, 2012. And he wanted to leverage the Erlang virtual machine, be bytecode compatible, be compatible with all the libraries that exist, but really build on some modern features. That's Elixir. And Phoenix is just a framework that a web framework built on top of Elixir. And we're really pushing for, you know, we're a standard web framework, but we want to push beyond what you would think of as a web framework, because the web is more than just a web browser now. So that's why we tackle, we're great for just the web browser, but we also have clients to handle iOS, Objective-C, C#, if you want to run our real-time system on multi-platform.
I'm curious. I watched a talk from you talking about your transition from Rails. Yep. And how you came about like making Phoenix based off of the desires that you wanted to see in Rails. A lot of the influence comes from Rails. Well, maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
I did Rails professionally for 5 or 6 years. So I definitely borrowed a lot of ideas. And you know what happened, you know, I loved Ruby. I was really happy. I was really pleased with Rails up until I started hitting walls performance-wise. And also, every time I would want to build some kind of real-time communication in my application, I'd find out it was either really hard or impossible to do. And that's where, at the time when Meteor came out, I was like, oh, wow, this is like everything I want to be able to do in Ruby and Rails that I can't do. But I tried to do it anyway. So like what I ended up developing this gem called Sync that did real-time Rails features. The best thing I can say about it is it could be made to work, but to get real-time events in Ruby and WebSockets was like lots of layers of cruft where I had to run a separate process outside my application. I had to run an event loop in Ruby to even handle asynchronous posts back to the user. So it ended up being like I had to like use like two different concurrency models in Ruby, like an event loop. I don't have any hard numbers, but I knew it was not going to scale well, and I knew that it was very brittle, because if the event loop crashed, it was running in its own thread, and there's really no great way to monitor threads in Ruby, so I was having to write all this defensive code saying, if I want to push a real-time event to the user, and my thread for the event loop is for some reason crashed, please restart it. So like every time I called into the event loop, I had to write all this defensive coding. So that's where I started feeling like, you know, maybe Ruby isn't the best language to be solving these things. So that's when I started looking around. And WhatsApp at the time, they weren't $20 billion fame, but they had published a blog post saying they got a million connections per server. And that's where I was like, whoa, like what? I'm having language envy. Like I'm thinking maybe I can get a couple thousand out of this sync gem that I wrote. And that's where I was like, what do they build on? And they were built on Erlang. So that's where I kind of started my dive into Erlang. But it was, I couldn't find many resources to really get up and running. And that's when I remembered Jose Valim had started this language called Elixir. And that's kind of when I dove in and then was convinced that it was going to be the thing to solve the real-time needs.
Around when was that, when you were doing that searching?
Mid-2013, I think. Okay. Was when I got into Elixir. And then I started the framework probably, I think I started, my first commit was in like December 2013 on the framework itself.
That's kind of awesome. It's kind of hard to get a commit in on Meteor.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Not an easy process.
Just a troll, man.
Yeah. Whatever. If they made it easier, I wouldn't have anything to talk about, would I?
So, Chris, I'm curious, your decision, I think it's probably because it was in 2013, but your decision to make your own templating language reminds me a lot of the syntax seems very similar to Python's. Just curious why you didn't choose to go the route of Angular or now React. Obviously, this is pre-React, but...
On the server, you mean? Like EEX templating?
Yeah.
So EEX is part of the Elixir standard library. So just a side story, I was a HAML user exclusively for 4 years, if anyone's familiar with HAML.
Yes.
I'd say it's not like Jade, but let's say, you know, coming from the Meteor side, like it's a templating language that kind of abstracts HTML a little bit. And I was pleased with that. So I used that for 4 years. And when I came into Elixir, I actually initially started using a HAML project in Elixir. But as with anything, it's like I'm in a new language. I'm reevaluating my tooling. Like I'm totally rebuilding part of my tooling, right? Web framework that I really had a change of heart around HAML and typing languages in general. Because this is the first time I've built anything of this size, but like building a web framework, like suddenly I got to see like all the complexity internally, like how many dependencies are there and what you're actually relying on code wise. And it really changed the way I view dependencies. For me, templating language that adds a ton of things on top of HTML is not worth, like the benefits are you're writing slightly more terse HTML. And to me, like writing HTML has never been the bottleneck in my application. And the trade-off is like you have this extra layer of complexity and you're now depending on a library that runs your entire view stack, that if there's a change in Elixir that breaks it, now you have to wait for this library to run just to render HTML slightly more freely. So anyway, yeah, that's why I just went with what the standard library provided, and it's like the most simple solution. You can just interpolate Elixir within markup, but really it's you interpolate Elixir within, it doesn't parse the HTML. It's just you write markup, and then when you want to do dynamic things, you write Elixir within the template. So,
you know, coming from kind of the Meteor mindset, we've got DDP with WebSockets to transfer data, but I'll say like scaling isn't the greatest story there, because like running live query takes up a lot of memory, pushing that data down. Like it doesn't scale to a ton of users consuming data. I think I'm on a 2 gig box. It's got two processors. I'm only running one instance right now, but you know, I'm kind of running out of memory there. Like, what does it look like? How does channels work, I guess? And then what does that look like for you guys in a typical app?
Yeah, so I didn't introduce Phoenix Channels very much, but Phoenix Channels was kind of like, that's why I built the framework, where I was trying to do real-time events in my Rails applications. So Phoenix, you know, has all these other things to render HTML forms and HTML, but Channels is the real-time layer, and that was kind of the whole reason the framework exists. Channels existed before you could render HTML templates. But Channels, it's our real-time layer that it abstracts the transport protocol. So like we ship with a WebSocket and long-form transport by default. But the whole goal is you shouldn't have to care how your client's connected. Like we have this Internet of Things, we have CoAP, we have all these protocols for connecting devices. But at the end of the day, I just want to write code on my back end that pushes messages back and forth. So that was the goal with Channels. And then we also, I took some inspirations from like Socket.io, where, you know, you just want it to be as trivial as possible to write a client and receive and push real-time events back and forth. So Socket.io is kind of an inspiration there, but Socket.io only has events, and we kind of added a layer on top of Channels where you have this topic that you subscribe to and you push events back and forth on a topic. And the scaling story there is quite good. Because where the way Elixir's and the Erlang concurrency model works is we have these lightweight processes, which are not like operating system processes, but very like lightweight units of concurrency. So when like the WhatsApp blog post or the most recent Phoenix blog post, we got 2 million channel clients per server. That means we had at least 2 million processes running on that server for each connection. And for Channels, we supervise that process. So the server was probably running like 3 million processes, and those were all real clients connected. So our concurrency model is very good for supporting lots of concurrent connections. The problem is, or not a problem, but where Meteor comes in, DDP is really interesting, but you would build something like Meteor's DDP and Meteor's reactive front end on top of Channels. I would say it's lower level. Like it's trivial to push messages back and forth, but it's more like you have the plumbing. So if you could create a front-end framework like Meteor on top of Phoenix Channels. But out of the box, we don't give you a client-side templating language. We don't give you a way to sync data back and forth. We make it easy to do that. You can push an event and sync data, but you have to roll that yourself on the client. So I would say there is a little bit of a disparity there, but one of my big focuses is having a lot of these frameworks, whether it's Meteor, we have a Dockyard, we're playing with an Ember.js or Ember data adapter to do a lot of what Meteor DDP does over Phoenix Channels. So yeah, it's more like our real-time plumbing that we want to see people build things on top of. And it should scale like quite well. Like I said, we had the 2 million connections that we got on a server that used about 80 gigabytes of memory. So it took quite a bit of memory, but we got 500,000 clients out of 16 gigs of memory to give you an idea of something more commodity related.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm finding that's definitely the limitation, at least for me. Like, I don't, maybe I just don't write like super CPU intensive apps or something, but I'm finding that just having the connected user consuming the memory is where you end up incurring a lot of the cost for these real-time frameworks.
So yeah, and I mean, some of it is unavoidable.
Yeah. I mean, you have to query data and push that data back to someone, and you have to know that you've pushed that data, right? Kind of keep that state.
Right. And then you have to, if you're running, like, if you want to run more than one server, you have to somehow broker those messages across nodes and whatnot. And that's where Elixir's concurrency model is distributed. So if you're running a server running 2 million users per server and you broadcast an event, it just works over the network. There's no code that you have to write. You don't have to run Redis in between or some message queue. Like, I'm not sure what Meteor does to bridge, but there's no, for us, we just send a message to a process, and if you're running multiple servers and they're clustered together, there's nothing, your code doesn't change.
Yeah. That. Yeah. Meteor is using Mongo and relying on Mongo's oplog to kind of be that
gotcha.
Transport point, I guess.
So then every server then just monitors the log separately. And that's
yeah.
I see.
Yeah. But, you know, the problem there is, like, if you have a high write load to your database, then that's potentially bad because you're having to process, like, every server's processing every write message to see if they care about it. So, but supposedly Mongo's going to fix that at some point. You'll be able to subscribe to the oplog and ask for the stuff you care about. Which could be nice. You know, you said Dockyard's working with Ember. I've seen a number of people talk about like a Peep stack as well, which is like Phoenix and Elixir and Postgres and Ember, right?
Yep.
And then other people are talking about React as well. Does that seem to be becoming more popular in the Phoenix community as well?
Yeah, I'd say Ember and React are probably the biggest use that I see just kind of like on IRC and Slack. I think quite a few people use Angular as well. There's an Angular library that wraps channels. So I think it's pretty broad. Like, the framework doesn't impose any, we don't have any conventions or like we don't bless a single framework. So, you know, it's the plumbing's there. And, you know, what I like to see is like, you know, we have some folks like we'll probably talk about using Meteor and also talking to Phoenix channels. You know, they're using Meteor with Phoenix channels. So I'd like to see all these frameworks, like we're seeing already, you know, there's have an Ember data adapter over channels, and that way it works with whatever client you have. So we don't have to bless a particular one. You know, React is what has made the most sense to me personally so far. Ember, I'm still like an Ember noob, but I think Ember, the nice thing about Ember is I'd say it gives you the closest client-side experience to what Meteor is going to offer. From my like 1,000-foot view, I haven't used Meteor or Ember seriously to build an application, but as far as a framework that gives you everything you want to have a full like reactive client-side app, I think that they kind of go head-to-head, but Ember is obviously only the front-end side of things, where Meteor is going to give you everything.
I don't know. I'd love to see DDP like become a standard or something that a bunch of people adopt, but I don't think that's realistic. So I wonder if it's maybe our hope lies with something coming out of Facebook, like using GraphQL on top of Phoenix channels or something like that to kind of create a standard that people can get behind. Have you put much thought into that? Have you paid attention to GraphQL at all?
Yeah. So I looked at DDP briefly. I actually want to take a second look at it when we get into this Ember data adapter. The problem is like all these frameworks bless a certain kind of thing, right? So Ember data is the JSON API spec. So that'd be the easiest way to wire up channels over Ember data would be to serialize it as JSON API, send that over the wire. GraphQL, I'm really interested in. My talk at ElixirConf a few months ago, I talked about a lot of the inspirations we want to take from GraphQL and add to the framework from a backend perspective, where I think a lot of the GraphQL benefits that you get on the client, you could also apply to server-side rendering. Yeah, I agree with you. It's like there are so many competing standards, and I ran into this when I developed channels itself. Someone, like people have asked me, why didn't I use the WAMP protocol, which is like a WebSocket sub-protocol? And why didn't I do DDP right away? So it's like there are all these different choices. And for me, I can't start with a protocol and then develop around it. It's like I have this plumbing and now it's like, okay, for me, it makes sense to try to find a serialization standard but I haven't seen one emerge quite yet. But my eyes are on GraphQL for sure.
Speaking of Ecto, because like I said, I've been playing around with Elixir and Phoenix for only a couple weeks. Ecto seems like a pretty robust data layer. Is that what was kind of the inspiration for Ecto?
Yeah, so Ecto is actually a larger project than Phoenix, which is interesting. Like we're working on a programming Phoenix book for PragProg, and quite a lot of the book is about Ecto. And it was just funny that we didn't expect that to happen, but then we actually started talking about how, like, if you compare the code base of Ecto to Phoenix, Ecto is much larger. So yeah, Ecto is a robust data layer, and the idea behind it is it's like the repository pattern where you compose your queries and then you send that off to a repo. I come from a Rails background, so if you're familiar with Active Record in Rails, at least the Active Record pattern that Rails, how Rails applied it, is you really have no glimpse into when you're accessing the database or not. I mean, you kind of do, but you have an object and you say object.save or user.post, and that internally is going to create a query somewhere. So the problem with that approach that we ran into historically is you lose any kind of insight into when you're accessing the database. So it's like when I render a template in Rails, somewhere in that template, someone's going to call user.posts.first5. Give me the first five posts. And if they haven't prefetched those posts in their controller, they're going to lead to like N+1 query issues because it's going to have to make a fetch for each of those posts as it iterates to render them. So you need to be really careful in Rails, and there are like all these companies exist just to like identify N+1 queries in Rails apps. I should say Jose is the mastermind behind Ecto, but the big idea there was your repo access separates the data access from the actual querying. So the data access is always explicit. If I see like a repo operation in my app, that means I'm accessing the repo over the network and doing some expensive work. And it makes that as explicit as possible. So you can't accidentally write to the database or accidentally read somewhere nested in a template. All data has to be fetched explicitly up front, and then rendering becomes this like pure functional operation.
Some people in the Meteor community, maybe Ben, for example, might be uncomfortable with this. Jumping from a JavaScript sort of syntax to a purely functional syntax is, it takes some getting used to, but, certainly, Ben, I would highly suggest you give it a shot because it's once you start to see how these functions, you can pipe them through each other. That's a big thing in programming Phoenix was piping. Because these, in Ecto, your queries are composable, it was very interesting to see how you can pipe your queries through each other.
I mean, I respect all you guys. And I just like, I'm trolling our Slack group and all stuff, and that's just what I'm doing. But ultimately, like, I don't know if I could like do a little thing of what I see here. React came and there was a bunch of people like crapping on it at first. And they're like, JSX, what the hell is this? Blah, blah, blah. And they you know, they would just like nudge at it or stab it a little bit. Other people would say, oh, this is just a flavor of the week, you know? And then now look at where React is. You know, a couple of years later, when I first heard of Phoenix, I thought of the same thing. And now more and more people are talking about it. Chris, I'm hearing you talk about it and all the thought process that was behind it. The performance is insane. And so it's like, well, you know, maybe I got to stop poking it and just like give it a shot. A huge part of this, like if this is going to be a huge thing that companies are going to be built on top of, maybe you can talk a little bit about the community side of things, Chris, like contributors and maintaining such a large project and how that has gone so far.
Yeah, so the community side of things is really fantastic. And I will say my goal I'm halfway there. So my goal for the rest of the year, starting like a few months ago, was to kind of balance my life out because working full-time at work and then working full-time on a framework, it was just a lot.
Do you have kids?
No, not yet.
Okay.
Dockyard was like, you know, obviously a huge boost in I can focus the majority of my working hours on the framework. So that was something that had to happen for me personally, just because it's just trying to follow up on support requests and the framework itself is a full-time job, right? The community that's built up around Elixir and Phoenix has been really great. Like it's very very helpful community. We're very encouraging, especially because I think we know, like we were talking about with the functions and piping and thinking functionally is like the first 2 weeks you're going to be like, I hate this. This is stupid. When I got into Elixir, I was like, I couldn't even do like a recursive loop. Like I was going through the programming Elixir book and I was like, I can't program. Like I have a programming degree and I can't make a list loop. So it takes a while, but like once it clicks, you're like, oh my, this is the best thing ever. And now trying to go back to like Ruby or object oriented language, like it just doesn't feel right. But it takes a little bit. So I think the community has done a great job of like saying that we know there's this frustration gap that needs filled. So like we're very helpful to newcomers and noob style questions is more, the more the merrier, the faster we can get people over that hump, the better. And on the contributor side, I'd say that we have quite a small core team. I think there's five of us and Jose Avilim, the creator of Elixir, is actually on the core team, and that's been an enormous boost. So he's written, I think he probably has half the commits in Phoenix. So, but still quite a small core team. And we're actually shocked at the number, the few issues that we do have. So we expected with 1.0 that we'd have a lot more issues to tackle. So there is no gauntlet. Like people are using the framework, companies are using it, but not to like pat us on the back, but like it's been surprisingly stable. Like surprisingly few problems have cropped up. So for me personally, it's like, you buy into the Kool-Aid of whatever platform you're on, right? It's like, it's just, you do, right? There's no reason not to. Or it's unavoidable. But the problem,
right.
The interesting thing for me is like, functional programming, the zealots are like, it leads to more maintainable code, your code's more understandable, you write fewer lines of code, and you're like, you buy into functional programming and you're like, yeah, fewer lines of code, it's more maintainable. But like every step of the way building Phoenix, like the hype has like lived up to the reality. Like every new feature we write, like we wrote the Phoenix HTML layer, and Jose and I we're walking through the code and we're like, where is all the code? Like, it was shockingly small amount of code. And we have like a lot fewer issues than we expect. I think there are like five open issues or six open issues on Phoenix right now.
And half I'm there right now and I'm in disbelief that you have eight.
Yeah. And people are using it, right?
So, I'm just like,
so it's been cool to watch from a perspective of like functional programming for me has lived up to the hype so far. Buying into the Kool-Aid and then having it actually live up to the hype has been fun. Obviously, we'll see what happens in a few years, but I think so far it's really encouraging as far as like we said like, oh, we're going to use Elixir for a web framework because it's going to be scalable. And then, we got 2 million connections on a server and it's turning out to be very maintainable. So far, it's been a good ride.
Now, has there been like any big pushes from the community like for features that they're like waiting for and they're like, oh, I'm just like ready to launch this startup, but I need this feature? And
there's no big blocking features. One that I'm working on now is a channel presence. So basically like who's in this, if you wanted a chat room list, like who's online right now, that's not provided by the framework. That's what I'm working on for the next big version bump of Phoenix. But the problem is like the way most people solve that is incorrect. Because it's easy to solve if you only ever have one server. As soon as you have more than one server, you get into like a distributed computing problem. And at that point, most people would just shove it in a database or some central Redis. But we're trying to leverage this distributed runtime. So we're going to have each node keep a CRDT, conflict-free replicated data type, and kind of leverage the distributed environment we have to make that presence information fully distributed. That way you don't have a single source of truth. And if a node goes down, you can notify, all the other nodes can notify, hey, I saw this node suddenly dropped offline. All the users that were on that node, we need to broadcast to anyone connected that, hey, this user's gone. So that's really the next big feature that people are kind of itching for. You can do it today, but like I said, most people that implement it do it incorrectly. Otherwise, it's been like I call it on-demand driven development. So like if you have Phoenix in production and you need a feature, that's usually the big push for me to implement something. Otherwise we don't make up work for ourselves unless we see a good reason to. So usually it's been, if it's not there, someone to say, hey, I'm building X with this, I need Y and Z. And then if it's a good reason, we'll add it.
So I did 9 years of Rails and, okay, cool. I remember, the original package system, which was actually pretty terrible. And then they moved to Ruby Gems, which was slightly better, but Meteor has a really, really strong kind of package story to it. What does that look like in Elixir and in Phoenix? You know, as someone, I have no idea what that looks like.
Yeah, we have, Elixir has its own package manager called Hex. And it uses the bundler, which is the RubyGems, uses something very similar to the bundler algorithm for dependency conflicts. But since you've done Rails, I think you probably have run into issues where if you have a dependency conflict on dependencies that you don't own, you're basically screwed, right? It's like bundler would be like, I can't find a resolution between these dependencies, and your only option is to like fork the dependencies. If someone's depending on like Hashi or some library that like everyone uses, but then it's out of date, bundler historically is just throwing its hands up. So anyway, Hex has kind of solved some of those issues where I can force it to use a version or use a dependency. Like if there's a dependency conflict, I can just say, sorry, use this version of that conflict, and it will just do its best. So anyway, the dependency store is quite good. It's hex.pm is the website, and you could search for packages there. We're seeing quite a few. If you search for Phoenix, you'll see quite a few packages Phoenix related. You just drop a dependency in your mix file, and you just say mix steps.git, and it will pull the dependencies down, do conflict resolution. And it's for me, it's a better story than I had in Ruby, at least, because it basically vendors all your dependencies. So there's no global gem store. It's just all your dependencies live within the app, very similar to like Node, except it doesn't recursively store dependencies like Node does. It's like you only get one version of a dependency, and that's it.
So this is something that's consumed on the Elixir level. Are people able to write packages for Phoenix that maybe come with some UI attached? So for instance, like, you know, if I'm using Meteor, I can say like Meteor add user accounts colon bootstrap, and it'll bring in like all the boilerplate HTML I need to get like login working. So it's got the backend code to kind of put the database structure in place for user accounts. And then it's got all the UI code as well, kind of done up in Bootstrap and available.
The way Elixir, we tackle this in Elixir community, we have a build tool called Mix. That's all a command line tool. If you're familiar with Ruby, it's like Rake and Bundler combined. But it does even more than that. It will compile your project. It will run your tests. It will pull down dependencies, and you can run your own custom tasks with it. What we're trying to do, like with Phoenix, there's no Phoenix binary. Like you don't run Phoenix new, you run Mix Phoenix new to generate a new Phoenix project. So it's all Mix related. So there isn't like these one-off binaries for every project. It's just you write a Mix task, and then the user would run Mix user accounts.bootstrap, and then that would copy the HTML boilerplate into the project. But usually we try to keep things Mix driven as much as possible, because that way it's not like we've run into it with Rails. You have Rake DB migrate, but then you have Rails new, and I think Rails 5 is moving towards Rails DB migrate. I think they're moving away from to running a Rails command. From the user's perspective, they're familiar with Mix, so if we make everything Mix task related, it's much easier to debug, contribute, and also follow along.
You know, I think maybe the thing I was trying to get at was the idea of like, I can write some HTML and serve it from a package into my Meteor app. Is that something that you can do, like serve up those UI files from
some kind of package? Like much more, yeah, something that you could, like almost like a Rails engine.
Exactly. This yeah, so, like Meteor is very much what I wish Rails engine would have been.
Gotcha. We don't have engines intentionally. Phoenix is built on top of a web library called Plug, which is kind of like Rack. I'm not sure what Node's equivalent would be. But the plug contract is very simple, where it's all just a stack of functions. So you would have a library that would just be a normal hex package, and then you would plug that in your Phoenix pipeline, like in your router. If I wanted user accounts, I could say plug, or I would route to a user accounts plug that would intercept that connection, send some HTML down that it served up from its local templates, and then halted the connection so downstream no one else would try to handle it. So we're trying to stay within this single idea of the plug middleware and plug contracts. I'd say it's not quite as seamless as running like Mix Hex user accounts and suddenly my application has user accounts. There's a little bit more involvement that the user has to like plug that in their pipeline and And so far that's been intentional, but I do think we could probably improve the story a little bit around shared features. It's doable today, but it's not, there's no one way to do it, I should say.
And I remember in the Programming Phoenix book, you and Jose focused a lot on data security, a lot more than I've seen in any other intro to a framework book. Talk about password hashing, you talk about SQL injection attacks and a few other things. That is that something that you or Jose have a background in?
So Jose came from the Rails core team. He was a Rails core team member. He's written, if you've worked in Ruby, you've used software that he's written for sure. He wrote like Devise, which is a user authentication framework. He wrote form management. So he's had a lot of experience with one, having to solve these security issues, and two, having people either ignore them or solve them badly. So we wanted to make sure, especially with SQL injection, like in Rails, in Active Record, I'm not sure how it is on the Mongo side with Meteor, but Active Record protects you from SQL injection, but you can still just give it a string, interpolate some user input, and you're screwed. Like, so it does its best, but you can still, it still allows you to shoot yourself in the foot, which sometimes like there's no way to avoid, right? But with Ecto, it's actually interesting that at compile time, Ecto will not allow you to perform self, like it won't allow you to do SQL injection on yourself. it's impossible. Like if you try to compile a string and interpolate some input, it's going to like blow up and tell you you can't do this. So I think a lot of the Jose's experience with being on Rails core and solving the security issues, but and then also having people write very insecure Rails applications has led to a lot of the design decisions that you see in Ecto and Phoenix, because we know that, you know, you can be the best programmer in the world, but someone somewhere on the team is going to, if they can interpolate a user input in a string and send that to the database they're going to, right? It's just, it's going to happen. So we've gone to great lengths to try to avoid those simple fixes avoid those simple issues.
That's totally a big issue in the Meteor community, because people don't realize, like, you know, if someone just passes in a variable and they put it into their query, like they don't realize like you could just inject Mongo operators in there instead of like a username or a user ID or something, and that leads to some pretty major security holes.
Well, and Josh, you've written some articles about it, about the allow deny and a lot of the things that people don't realize are going on.
Yeah.
Well, how does that work? So I wasn't familiar, because like Mongo has its own query language, right? So like what's the protection or sanitization look like on the Mongo side, since it's not just a string, right? Like
you can, with Meteor, you get a method called check. There's another library called match that you can use, and you can say like match this object or match this string, or you can give it any number of things to make sure that they're passing in the right kind of input that you want to pass. And you can even like really drop down and get crazy with regexes and stuff, which isn't too bad, but I think it's not like super intuitive to the user. A lot of people just don't think, oh, I should try to think about what some is going to try to input into this form here and try to get away with a bunch of stuff. Most people just don't think that way. Like I think that's something that you're right. Like after you've done it for many, many years, you kind of figure that out. And, you know, I remember like using Simple Form and Devise, and, you know, Jose was my hero for a lot of that stuff. So that was pretty awesome.
Chris, you, I noticed that you chose to use Brunch instead of Webpack. I'm sure you've been asked that a number of times.
Yeah. So that's the best answer for this. Yeah. So I spent about 2 weeks of my life trying out different Node build tools. I started with Grunt, and then I did Gulp. I think then Webpack, then Brunch. There's another one. There were five.
Okay.
So I spent like a ridiculous amount of hours picking one for the framework, because what we didn't want to write our own asset builder. Like lots of human hours have gone into these.
Sure. Yeah.
There's no reason for the framework or for us to deal with it. But the problem was every one of them I tried had like serious trade-offs. The Node ecosystem itself is just, it's like a paradox of choice. Like there are a lot of good options, but there just are a lot of good options. I settled on Webpack and then, and Brunch. So Webpack was a close second. And the nice thing is, if you want to use Webpack in Phoenix, it's about 20 seconds of work. and Phoenix will still run Webpack for you. And so we integrated Brunch in a way that it's easy to swap out. But the problem with Webpack is I think it's really opinionated and it's not a great default for a generalized asset builder. I mean, this is several months ago when I made this decision, but I think at the time all the CSS was concatenated within JavaScript. And I was told that there's a package that will build CSS as a CSS bundle, but it was like experimental, not recommended. Maybe that's changed. But at the time, from the framework perspective, if I have to make a bet like 5 years out, I'd have to explain to people over and over again, like, hey, all your CSS and images are actually baked into JavaScript. And I was like, that's not a good default, right? Like if someone just wants to throw CSS in a CSS folder and throw JavaScript in a JavaScript folder and have that show up on the front end, bundled together. For me, Webpack wasn't the default. But I loved the static analysis that it did. So being able to just throw in dependencies and it just does static analysis and sucks all that in was awesome. So Brunch went out because Brunch was super fast and super simple. It was just, you didn't have to know JavaScript. You just have a JSON configuration file and you put your JavaScript in Webstatic JS, put your CSS in Webstatic CSS, and like you're done. A lot of people use Webpack still, especially like if they want to use React. Trying to get React set up with Brunch is kind of a pain because it doesn't do NPM dependencies yet. So I'm really looking forward to Brunch 1. Brunch 2.1, their biggest priority is adding official NPM support. That way you can just say, add React node package and you're done. But it was the most frustrating and unpleasant process of building Phoenix was the asset story. And I think we hit a happy solution with Brunch, but Node remains our biggest issue, the biggest source of issues, where someone will have trouble setting Node up on Windows, or someone will have, like just last night, I spent about 45 minutes helping someone get like Semantic UI, it's a front-end framework, set up with Brunch. And it wasn't Brunch's fault, it wasn't Phoenix's fault, it was just Brunch, or Semantic used less, I don't know, it's just like, Semantic UI uses a Gulp workflow. And if you want to build Semantic from source, they ship with Gulp and they have a guide on using Gulp. Well, this person wanted to edit their theme, the less theme, using Brunch with Phoenix. And I was like, well, you can either swap out Brunch with Gulp or I help them port the Gulp setup to Brunch. So anyway, there's just so many, this is a long answer, but there's so many choices in the Node ecosystem, which I'm sure you're all aware. And maybe Meteor solves a lot of that by having its own tooling, or maybe not solves, but adds to the other options. But at least Meteor's all-encompassing, kind of. So there's just so many options that you've got to pick one, and I'm still not sure. You know, 5 years from now, I'd rather not have to be back in the same spot, but the way the JS ecosystem is, you know, we'll see. But for now, Brunch is a great, I think, default, and if you want something else, it's pretty easy to swap.
Well, it's like HD DVD versus Blu-ray, right? No one wants to pick the HD DVD.
Right.
You know, but honestly, I've kind of heard similar things from a lot of people. Like Webpack is just this time sink of 2 to 3 hours of like figuring out the configs and
that's worse than that.
trying to get it working. Well, I don't know. Like I'm just going off other tweets I've seen. I actually haven't done it, but you know, it's funny you say that.
It's total yak shave. Yeah. Like, get the biggest shaver you have. Because you're going to about shave the biggest yak of your life.
No, I thought it's kind of funny that we're talking about Brunch versus Webpack too, because David Greenspan had this kind of analysis where he took a couple weeks and sat down and played with both. He played with a bunch of options and was kind of trying to evaluate the different options available. And he actually said that he thought Brunch was actually the better project, but you know, everyone would be like, what the hell? Like, why did you go with Brunch? Like, no one's heard of Brunch.
Well, they're like, wait, Brunch was made like 3 years ago. Like, that's like 100 years ago in the new ecosystem.
That's a dinosaur.
Yeah, but Brunch 2.0 just came out. So, and with NPM support, I think it would be less of a reason to like let's just drop Brunch for Webpack as people do today when they pick up Phoenix, because React and Brunch are they go hand in hand together, so there's a lot of write-ups on how to do that. So I think a lot of people that do React apps with Phoenix just pick Webpack, just because it's easier path. Otherwise, you have to like use Bower, but now like Bower's on with Brunch, you can use Bower, but then Bower's on the way out, right? Bower's dead or whatever. So we need NPM support, and I think once that comes, it'd be a happier path with most of the people coming in Phoenix.
You know, maybe that's the other thing I'm kind of curious to talk about, because I've had a couple conversations with Ben, and you know, I think his stance is just, I don't really care about Phoenix or Elixir or Erlang because I like writing JavaScript and I think JavaScript is always going to be here. So like, I'll just keep writing in that language. Do you build many apps with Phoenix, and do you find like that shifting back and forth from like a front end piece of the app to the back end? Like, is that hard for you?
That's never been a problem for me. And I'll try to be as fair as possible here. We write JavaScript because that's the only option on the client. I mean, we have transpilers now, but the only compelling use case of JavaScript is it runs everywhere on the browser, right? It runs everywhere, but that's the language the browser speaks. I think on the server, it's much less compelling. The only argument being you can write both one language on the client and server. But for me, and I'm biased, like that's not a compelling reason to say, let's just not use a better language suited to server development because we can not have that context switch. The longer answer is and this goes for a lot of languages, I don't see them having a future in the multi-core age, where if the answer to concurrency is threading or avoiding threading and just using an event loop, I don't see that being a good story 5 to 10 years from now. So if we have 100 core CPUs on the horizon, like the answer can't be to run your Meteor app on 100 cores, you run 100 node processes and cluster them together, right? I just don't see that being a compelling way that we deploy applications. But that's the reality of a multi-core age. Like unless we have new CPUs somehow in the next 5 years, like we're going to have more and more cores, and we're going to have more and more trouble having these cores work on JavaScript or Ruby or any object-oriented language.
We are going to have larger chips or faster chips, right? Because of graphene.
We're going to have graphene. Oh, right. Yeah. 30 years, maybe we'll go back to JavaScript. So anyway, my long answer, though, is like...
I'm hanging on here.
Yeah. The cool thing, the cool thing about the Erlang concurrency model in Elixir is all the processes that we run. So if you're running 2 million users on a server, those 2 million processes are load balanced on IO and CPU. So there's no way for you, if you're doing some CPU bound task, one of those 2 million users triggers some task that does something very intensive. That's not going to take out all the other 2 million users, right? Like in Node, you have to be very, very careful. And I know like there are good patterns to avoid this, but like you can do any CPU bound task in Node or you kill the entire server, right? Pretty much like 2 million users suddenly are now, they have an unusable app. So the concurrency model is, for me, the only one that I've seen that gets around all the issues of other languages. So yeah, I went on a tangent there, but yeah, I don't see JavaScript in the multi-core age being a good solution, unless maybe it evolves with ES20
or 2020.
What would they call the 2020 versions? I think, yeah, to be fair, I think JavaScript's getting a lot better. I'm a big fan of ES6, ES20, 15. Mm-hmm. A lot of the stuff we're doing has made JavaScript a lot more pleasurable for me, but on the server, like I said, and this goes for a lot of languages, I don't see the concurrency story holding up to the realities of modern computing. Hmm. And maybe the argument of, well, it's fast enough and memory's cheap will continue to be true. But I think what we're seeing with companies moving, like Bleacher Report moved from Ruby to, or Rails to Phoenix, and they went from like dozens of servers to two servers. Actually, they only need one server, but for redundancy, they added a second. And it just sits at a few percent CPU under load, and they get like tens of millions of users per month. So I think the argument of servers are cheap and memory's cheap is a lot less compelling when you can actually have an order of magnitude reduction in your servers. And I think,
what about when you have to scale your team?
That's one thing that I often think about is like, you don't have to go hire an Elixir specialist. You know, you can just hire good JavaScript people and they can probably work on the entire stack. And that's been interesting to kind of watch happen in at least Meteor companies.
there's no way we can match that kind of hiring story. I mean, it's just having to know a separate language is definitely going to be a barrier to hiring, I'd say, upfront. But if you look at, I like to use WhatsApp. It's a great marketing story for the Erlang Elixir platform. But they have a lot of compelling use cases for the platform. So like they started as, they weren't an Erlang team. And they all basically leveled up on Erlang and then built this platform to support a billion people. And I think at the time of acquisition, they had 400 million users and 30 engineers. And I think only half of those were actually on Erlang. The other 30 were working on the front-end clients and whatnot. So they were able to go from, you know, non-Erlang experts to this system supporting hundreds of millions of people with, you know, a couple dozen people total. So I'd say that the hiring story up front is you're going to find a lot less experts, but it's actually a lot easier than people would think to level up on the platform. But I do think, like you said, that the front end story of if I know JavaScript, I can use Meteor on the back end is compelling, but I don't see it holding up 5 years from now. But
well, maybe let's ask. Let's ask Sam.
Well, I would say it has a lot less to do with learning a new language than it does learning functional programming. That's really learning immutable data structures and learning how everything needs to be a pure function where nothing has side effects to really rethink how you build apps. Almost every function seems to be recursive when you're in functional programming. And that takes a lot of getting used to. But once you see how it all pieces together, so I imagine if you were to hire a Lisp developer or something like that, they could probably pick up Elixir pretty quickly.
Yeah, I would agree. That's a good point. Yeah, for me, it was my first functional language. So I think a lot of people, it probably would be their first true functional language. The main barrier is like rewiring your brain. Just like if one of us, if we knew Ruby and we went to Python, it wouldn't be this great wall that we'd have to overcome. But yeah, I think that is, training is a big barrier, but I think, you know, I do training at a lot of conferences. So I think, you know, we're trying to fill that gap in the community with as much material as we can. But that would be an argument we would face with hiring managers, right? So I don't have a good answer for you other than like you're right, but we can train them.
What about like at Dockyard? So like you're a consulting firm and you have to be competitive on price. There's other consulting firms out there offering different stacks. And now you guys are moving over to Phoenix. And so now you guys are building out your Erlang and Elixir knowledge and your developers on your team. Do all the Elixir developers, since they're like in high demand, or there's like a smaller ground, like amount of them, like do you have to double their salaries once they learn it or something like that?
No, but it's a good point. It's interesting. And I think Brian, he's the founder of Dockyard. He's made a good point about this issue because like they make bets on early technologies that they see becoming big deals. Like they bet on Ember very early. Part of that is the employees that you have become experts in that early technology that then becomes in high demand. So retaining employees definitely is much more a concern for Dockyard. As far as salary, you know, that's beyond my level of decisions that I make.
I kind of like put Dockyard on the side, but I'm wondering, like,
I think Brian has a blog post around this, or maybe I've talked to him personally, but he has, you know, this is definitely on his mind. It is something that, as a company, when you make bets on these technologies that you see being a big deal, you have to keep in mind. Like, that's, I think, I don't want to like toot Dockyard's horn, but you know, it's been a great company. The culture is really great, and I think part of that is it has to be, otherwise you're going to bleed talent because these people that know these new technologies that become a big deal can then just go off to some other company.
I think a better way to ask it, I shouldn't have put Dockyard in the crosshairs. So we got a lot of Node guys listening to the show right now. If you've convinced them to like try out Phoenix right now, along with that convincing, is there like, I don't know what the average hourly rate is for Elixir developers. Like, would they expect to charge more or whatnot?
I think programmers will demand a certain rate anyway. So I would say, like, what's the job market look like? You know,
that's another way to word it.
A lot of jobs out there.
More and more. I mean, it's definitely early days. If you go like Hacker News, who's hiring every month, right? There's usually three or four Elixir Phoenix related jobs for the last several months, which has been encouraging. I will say, as far as like competing on price, that's one thing that, I mean, one of the reasons Dockyard moved away from Rails is like Brian has a blog post on Dockyard. He talked about this, that As the market becomes more and more saturated, like, you don't want to compete on price. So moving into other technologies as a way to not have to have the lowest common denominator hourly rate rise. One thing I didn't realize getting into Elixir and creating Phoenix, like, was the business case that it makes. Like, that was never on my mind. Like, I created Phoenix because I wanted to, the kinds of applications I wanted to build, I couldn't build in Ruby. And I thought Elixir would be a great fit. But I wasn't thinking about how that would apply to the business case. So for me, from a hourly rate employment perspective, if I can come into a company and say, we can rewrite or write the system in Elixir and you can go from 100 servers to 2, to me, that's an easy business case to make to stakeholders and a way to justify your value very easily. Where, right. I mean, I came from Ruby. I mean, I think JavaScript, it might be different, but coming from Ruby, the business case we can make was, hey, we use the same conventions. We can build this project in less time, maybe. Or your team's going to be able to pick it up and be productive in it. That's not as compelling as, hey, we can give you this really productive, well-built project, and you can drop your overhead costs by an order of magnitude. So that's what I see as the biggest value from a job and contracting point of view, and convincing your current bosses and stakeholders that, hey, we should check this out.
Well, and if you're paying for, like, an order of magnitude less servers, you can then pay your employees double the salary, right?
That's true.
So, you know, you mentioned well-built, and one thing that has made me particularly sad, I'm going to troll here again for a minute, lately with Meteor, is the lack of testing. And, you know, there's one thing that I find super interesting about, I'm pretty sure it's with Elixir itself, is that the docs that they have are actually, like, that's the actual test suite. Is that correct?
Not all of our tests, but the tests that can be tested with docs, we enable. So, like, any test that's, like, if you have a function that has no side effects, you can write documentation for that function. And in the documentation, in the string of docs, you add an example of, here's how to call this function, here's what it should return. Elixir will test that doc, that documentation, actually run the code, and that will be a passing or failing test. So it's a way to keep your documentation up to date, which is awesome. But it doesn't work if you have, like, setup that is required outside of that. That makes sense. So you can't use it for everything, but you want to use it as much as you can. And yeah, our documentation is in Markdown, and it's first class. So in the terminal in your REPL, you can say you can bring up docs for your code or other library code just in the REPL. And you also can run mix hex.docs, and it will upload your docs as HTML to hexdocs.com. So all of your docs are just available online, accessible, and generated from the docs that you write in your code, which is nice.
That's kind of cool. So what, I mean, what's it look like if I decided to start writing a Phoenix app? What does that look like for me if I want to test it?
Yeah, so we have a good testing story. You know, I think we have a lot of Ruby influence for sure. I think that also leads to people having some pre-biases against us. But, you know, I think the Ruby community has done a great job with testing methodologies. So, yeah, we have a good testing story. We use the XUnit, which is the standard library test framework, but then we provide test helpers. So in Phoenix, you're going to get helpers to test your controllers and your web stack, and also to test your real-time layer. So you don't have to do a ton of setup yourself. You can just say, make a post request to this endpoint, and then assert the response was sent like you expected. So we have just enough test setup for you to cover probably, I don't know, 85% of what you need. And we're big on testing. I think, you know, obviously software has to be tested one way or another. So I'm not a TDD zealot, but I will say that however your software is written, it needs to have tests. I write my tests as like regression tests. So it's like, I have to prototype it out. And then once it works, I write tests around it. If you're writing code without testing, then you're not testing by hand over and over and over, right? Which, right, I'm sure you're probably used to.
Painfully aware of. Yeah. I saw a funny tweet from Eric Hodel the other day about, like, you know, it was a play on Beyonce's song. If you like it, you should have put a test on it.
Yep. Yeah. So I will say, like, you know, with Meteor though, I think if you go back on my Twitter feed long enough, you'll find a tweet that when a Meteor was announced, I tweeted out, like, I'm incredibly excited about this. So I think Meteor is like the only stack today where you have a good story on the front end and back end that just out of the box that you can roll with. So that's where I would like to see Phoenix as we as we grow, we have, you know, I would like to see front-end solutions that give you the Meteor experience, but with Phoenix on the back end.
Yeah.
Instead of just saying like, hey, pick up Ember data or pick up Angular or pick up the Meteor package that integrates with Phoenix. I'd rather have some one path that gives you that Meteor experience. And that's where I think Meteor has really excelled at.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I'm excited. You know, they've announced some interesting things going forward, and I think they're embracing NPM a lot more and embracing the ecosystem a little better outside of Meteor. And I think that will lead to some long-term kind of gains. So I think that'll be good. All right. Well, I think we're out of time. I just want to say thanks for coming on the show, Chris and Sam. Really appreciate it. Awesome conversation.
Yeah, we covered a lot.
Yeah, thank you. Hopefully I didn't rile too many feathers, because I think you guys are doing some cool stuff. But yeah, check us out if you're interested.
Yeah, no, I mean, we have you on here because we want people to understand, you know, what's available out there. And honestly, like, I'll be renaming this show to the Space Dojo Show, so it'll be a little less Meteor focused and a little more broad, but
more space ninja,
way more space ninjas.
You know, new framework by me coming out soon.
Yeah, cool.
the ninja framework.
Yes.
Space pirate.
So, like, Chris, like, where can people like find you?
Exactly.
Yeah. So phoenixframework.org has guides that you can get started on. I'm Chris_McCord on Twitter. If you want to. Check me out. And then IRC is where I live on Elixirlang. So Elixirlang IRC, if you're getting started with Elixir or Phoenix, is the place to be. I'm there most hours of the day, and I'm happy to help out. So check it out.
Nice. Cool. Where can we find you, Sam?
You can find me on Medium. You can find me on the internet. I'm around.
You're on the internet? Yeah. There's only like five people there. I'm so surprised you got in.
I'll have to check that out.
One of a few people named Sam Korkos, right? So
I'm one of one.
One of one. There you go.
Pretty. I have to attest, your Medium blog posts are awesome. You're kicking them out. So yeah, people go check those out for sure.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, as always, this show is supported by the listeners. And if you want to hang out in the chat room, I don't know if Chris wants to be in our chat room, but we'll maybe invite him to the Slack chat. He'll be like the dark horse in there, convincing everyone to switch to Phoenix.
I better go back and like delete all my history.
you can't see it because I can't afford to pay Slack for all the people in that room.
Perfect.
Yeah, but you can go to Patreon, patreon.com/Meteor Club, patreon.com/Meteor Club, and you can join there. $10 a month, and you'll get in that chat room as well, where Ben spews all his awesome all the time.
Awesome. Just spewing. Awesome. Yes.
All right.
That's a horrible word, man.
Thanks again.
Yep, thanks.
This podcast has been a Meteor Club production. You can find out more information about Meteor Club at meteorjs.club. It's pretty easy to join the mailing list and stay in the loop. Again, that's meteorjs.club.